Good evening to all of you. In behalf of the World Affairs Council, as mentioned, I'm Doug B. Wright, your moderator. It's now my pleasure to introduce this evening's distinguished speaker. Ann Lee is an adjunct professor of economics and finance at New York University and a former visiting professor of macroeconomics and financial derivatives at Peking University. She is the author of a very recent book entitled What the U.S. Can Learn from China, An Open-Minded Guide to Treating Our Greatest Competitor as Our Greatest Teacher. Also, she is a frequent media commentator on economic issues on such media outlets as the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, and Business Week. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Professor Ann Lee.
Thank you for such a kind introduction. And thank you for the World Affairs Council for hosting this wonderful event. And I'm really happy to be here to see all of you come out on the first rainy day of the season, I hear. It's terrific to see such a great turnout, and especially to come listen to such a heavy, weighty topic, such as what the U.S. can learn from China. Given that I understand that sex, money, and violence is what sells, unfortunately, this is missing all three. I was actually thinking the other day that if my publisher wanted to sell more books, perhaps they should have used a more misleading cover. Maybe a picture of Kim Kardashian walking down the wedding aisle with Yao Ming. Just a thought. Something very National Enquirer-like. So often, I get asked, why did I write this book? And this is particularly interesting for some of the folks who know me here, because I had spent about a dozen years on Wall Street as a bond trader and a credit derivatives trader. So I actually didn't do much writing back then. In fact, a friend of mine said that I was the only woman he knew that ever responded to his emails in one-word sentences. It was either yes, no, or maybe. And so obviously something really motivated me to write an 80,000 word manuscript. And the short answer is that I really was concerned about the direction that the U.S. was going. And my concern actually started back in 2005 when I was still working on Wall Street for a very large hedge fund. And I was trading these things called structured products, which most of you probably know now as the toxic waste that caused the 2008 crisis. And I had started to see a lot of deals come across my desk that were very irregular in nature. And I was very concerned about this and had raised it to the SEC, and they weren't responsive. And what really confirmed my suspicions about what was going on was that I had attended various broker-dealer events where I'd overhear investment bankers brag and joke about the fact that they could underwrite a billion-dollar deal secured with nothing but baseball cards. And so when it became clear to me that our regulators weren't going to do something about this, that was when I decided to leave Wall Street, because I had seen other booms and busts, such as the Asian crisis, the internet bubble, and I really believed that this one was going to be far, far worse. And so that was when I went to academia, and I proceeded to write a paper more or less outlining how this fraud was being perpetrated, and was really hoping to raise the awareness of the American people. And it was a very tough sell. In fact, one of my friends at Fox Business at the time had seen my paper, and so I thought that they would interview me about it. This Fox producer called me up and said, hey, Ann, we'd love to have you on. And I was getting all excited. And unfortunately, she said, we'd like you to debate whether Paris Hilton is a great American hero because she's a big consumer. This, unfortunately, was not what I wanted to hear. And I have to say that when the crisis finally happened in 2008, it did not shock or surprise me. What did surprise me was to the extent that government and Wall Street had come together. And after President Obama was elected and had appointed Larry Summers and Tim Geithner to his economic team, I really felt that it wasn't Obama that I should trust, put all my hope in. It actually turned out to be China. And if we take a step back and remember that it was only 30 years ago that China was written off as a lost cause. They were just an agrarian society, very backward in many ways. And it was a very recent development that they have become the second largest economy in the world. And this is even more amazing in that this had been a world empire for thousands of years. But then they had fallen to such a semi-colonial state only about 200 years ago because Western nations had invaded them and taken over. And it was when they had become this very weakened state that the folks such as Deng Xiaoping and Zhou Enlai, who were the Communist Party revolutionaries, who experienced this very harsh prejudice from foreigners when they were intellectuals in Paris, that they decided the reason why they were being so disrespected was because China was so weak. And so they wanted to make China strong again. And so this small group of friends turned this small kernel of an idea into this overwhelming movement that allowed them to take over the entire country in just 20 years. Unfortunately, once they took over the country, they managed to turn China into a weaker country. It was too bad that they didn't have the right policies in place. They didn't have the right people in place. And so they succeeded in causing mass starvation where millions of people died. More people died there than in World War II. And so it was a real tragedy because they were so married to ideology. Fortunately, Deng Xiaoping never gave up the hope. Many of his supporters also never gave up the hope to make China strong again and put China back on the right track. And so they continued to experiment and continued through trial and error to figure out what those right set of recipes of different policies would be to put China into a growth mode. And it was because they didn't give up and finally figured it out that China is what it is today. And so my book actually details those ideas that they used to make China a dynamic nation. And I wrote this book basically believing that these same ideas can reinvigorate the U.S. as well. I know that many of you think, how is that possible? They're very different nations. And I'm not advocating everything China here. What I am talking about are that there are certain principles that they use where we can take those elements and modify it and adopt it into a capitalist democratic society. And I'm hoping that some of those insights can actually help us overcome a lot of very intractable problems that we are facing today. And I understand that, you know, most folks have an emotional guttural reaction to China because you've heard so many of its worst features. But like all nations, they have weaknesses and strengths. And I believe that if we only dwell on their weaknesses, we're going to miss an opportunity to learn about their strengths. And it is through marrying the best of the West and the best of the East that hopefully we can develop a more enlightened and advanced civilization going forward. Because even though the United States is a great nation, and I love this nation to death, it is still not perfect. And we must continue to figure out how do we reform it, because times are changing very quickly, and we need to figure out a way to adapt. So I cover a lot of ideas in this book that I'm not going to have the time to talk about all of them here with you tonight, but I will want to share a few major themes that I think are particularly relevant in a presidential election year. One of them is the idea of leadership selection. Today, I believe that the United States is facing a crisis of leadership. Poll after poll is showing that our politicians have historic lows when it comes to how American citizens think about them. 60 Minutes reported very recently that Congress has a 9% approval rating. And it is no surprise when Occupy Wall Street then is spreading like wildfire across the nation and around the world. Now, this is very concerning, because whenever people do not view their government as legitimate, it causes the people in government to be defensive, and then they may resort to more drastic action to protect the status quo, to keep themselves in power. And we're already starting to see signs of this. President Obama signed a bill into law on New Year's Eve saying that Americans now can be detained indefinitely by our military, without trial, without evidence. And this is a huge incursion into our civil rights. This is why it is so important that we get the right people in places of leadership for this country. And this is particularly important when we've had campaign reforms that has failed to stop private capital from going into the election cycle. We now have a democracy that is not necessarily one person, one vote anymore, but more $1, one vote. So then how do we look at China for guidance on this, especially when we hear over and over again that China is a dictatorship? Well, if you ask folks outside of this country what they think of China, many times they will say that the Chinese have the best technocrats in the world. And if you ask the Chinese citizens what they think of their top leaders, over and over again, they give them very high approval ratings. Our own Pew Research out of DC have conducted research opinion polls for years now in China. And they report that over 80% of the population view them very positively. So how did they get this level of legitimacy? Especially when we hear over and over again that they are protesting against the land grabs and that the local governments are corrupt. And this is true. These people are very upset with the local government, but they are not upset with the very top guns running the country. So let me explain how they got to this level of legitimacy. The Chinese believe that the honor of running a country belong to the people who have earned the right to do it. This idea of earned authority is very similar to the way our corporations are run, because we don't elect a CEO to the top through some popularity contest. People work their whole lives doing different roles to prove that they are capable and competent and have the right knowledge to be a leader of an organization. And that is exactly how the Chinese system in the central government is run. First, if you want to go work in the central government, you must first pass a competency test by the time you're 35. If you don't, then you must stay in the private sector. And this is their way of trying to limit the revolving door to prevent or at least minimize the conflict of interest between the government and the private sector. Secondly, once you get into the government, then you have to prove yourself over your entire lifetime of career in showing that you are adding beneficial things to society. And you get rotated into these different positions around the country for 5-year terms, for a maximum of 2 terms. For instance, you could be a university president, and then you must demonstrate how in those 5 years you have increased the number of graduates who get jobs, or you increase the number of foreign exchange programs with other universities around the world. So there would be tangible things that they would be measured against, that everyone that has anything to do with that position get to rank them. So the students, other professors, their bosses get to rank them. If they do well, they get promoted to another position, perhaps mayor of another big city. If they don't, then they get demoted, and their compensation will reflect that. In this way, the Chinese try to better align public service with government officials so that there is no conflict there. And it is through decades of this kind of service before any of them are eligible for the top positions in the Politburo and the Standing Committee. Therefore, a lot of the citizens view that the people who make it to the top have already proven over decades how they have helped their country and that they are capable of doing that. And even the top 2 people are seen as just the top people amongst equals. So they run it as a group, and it's known as collective wisdom. And so what can we learn from this? In my book, I basically suggest that there are a few elements here that might help us better vet our leaders. The idea of competency tests is one of them that I bring up. This is not such a crazy idea. When we think about all the other professions that require competency tests, we require our doctors to pass medical boards. We require our lawyers to pass bar exams. We require architects to pass tests in order to get licensed. It seems like it's an anomaly that we don't ask our top public officials to also have any knowledge or competence to take the most powerful positions in the country. We do that for our foreign service. So if someone wants to be an ambassador for the U.S., they'll take that. But we don't really have that systematically for any other agency in the government. And this can be problematic because the saying, to the victor go the spoils, still holds true. Whoever gets elected to be president can assign top positions to people that may not be qualified to occupy those positions. They tend to go to people who have been large campaign donors, to people who they may owe political or other political favors for. And so, for instance, we had Michael Brown be assigned the head of FEMA during Hurricane Katrina under President Bush. This guy had no experience in emergency management. And we could see how the results did not turn out very favorably for the country. So what I'm saying is that I'm not asking that we completely change our system like China's. What I'm saying is that we can take very small elements to improve our system, because it would make sense that we would want competent people in charge of these things. Another area that I talk about is the idea of restricting the revolving door more, because it is a well-known business model where people can go work as a regulator or get elected and then come out and hang a shingle on K Street and earn millions as a lobbyist or other favors. And this kind of conflict of interest is very hurtful to society. Another thing I discuss is the idea of having maybe more of a track record that we require for people that want to run for top office, so that we know that they have the experience and the leadership to put positive change into an organization, and that they have shown humanity and that they want to serve the community. So these are just a few ideas that I talk about in one of my chapters. Another idea I bring up is the idea of long-term planning, because I believe that the United States today is suffering from a disease I call short-termism. We have many politicians that think only in two-year election cycles. We have many corporations that must respond to short-term profit demands from Wall Street. And I don't think there are enough people that are taking a step back and looking to see where do we want to be as a nation in 10 or 20 years' time, and how do we get there? And so when I look at the Chinese for ideas here, they have this idea called the five-year plan as a way to resist the temptation for short-term band-aids. A lot of people think that five-year plans are basically central planning, top-down dictates that they've seen under Mao that failed completely. But what I'd like to say is that the five-year plans today are not the five-year plans from our father's age or grandfather's age. The Chinese today have turned this exercise into a goal-setting exercise for the nation, where they can articulate their vision of where they want to be and then put specific performance targets on all areas of their economy. For instance, in their latest five-year plan from 2011 to 2015, they officially said they would like to have a greener economy. How are they going to get there? Well, number one, they would put a specific target of where they want to eliminate carbon emissions. They want to reduce it by 17% per GDP unit. They also say they want to reduce or increase higher efficiency in buildings by 16% per GDP unit. So they have specific targets in place, and then they enable the people who have those responsibilities to come up with the solutions on their own, to give them the autonomy. And they basically ask them to figure out a way to enlist the private sector to help them reach these goals. And thus, these people will use a mix of carrots and sticks, whether they will hike taxes for heavy polluting industries, offer tax incentives for new clean technology that could be coming out of the US, from Europe. And so a combination of these policies, along with some government investment, will enable them to eventually reach these goals. And a lot of people have heard of the five-year plan because it's more well-known. But they also have many other types of plans. For instance, a lesser well-known long-term plan is their 10-year talent plan. Here, the Chinese recognize that the vitality and the competitiveness of a nation is determined by the talent within the nation. And historically, the U.S. has been the number one magnet for talent around the world. So we can draw on the best of 7 billion people. The Chinese recognize that and say, we need to figure out a way to attract the best and brightest to our country if we want to stay competitive. Therefore, they draw up the 10-year plan where they say, we want to have X number of lawyers by a certain date, X number of social workers, X number of writers. And then they have the incentive to go and identify who these people are. They go and offer them great compensation packages, room and board, all sorts of enticements to try to attract new talent to the country. The U.S. does not have any industrial policy around our talent today. And this is a real tragedy because we have 3 million jobs that go unfilled for 6 months or longer. And many of these jobs are actually in technical fields. However, we don't have the talent because we're not encouraging that. In 2010, for instance, we had over 80,000 college students graduate with performing arts degrees, but less than 13,000 in electrical engineering. We need to figure out a way to rebalance our talent portfolio in this nation. We also need to figure out how to retrain a lot of people who are unemployed by a very fast-changing economy. Today, if someone is collecting an unemployment check, they can't go back to school and learn a new skill because if they do that, they will lose their unemployment check. We need to figure out better ways to align our policies with the realities there so that we can develop a workforce that can meet the challenges of the 21st century. So I see that my time is running short, and so maybe what I'll do is just wrap up here, and I will be taking questions from the audience. And so thank you.
Professor Lee, thank you very much for that very excellent introduction to the subjects of your recent book. As usual, we have some great questions here. The first two sort of fall in the category of questions you might not want to answer. And you have, I'll give you a pass if you'd like to avoid these two, because you and I were talking about this one we both get, as a matter of fact. Who do you think the right people are to vote for in November? If you want to pass that one, that's all right, too. And to show you what a warm and welcoming audience this is, I want to read you this one. Direct quote, Ann, dear, what should I invest in? So you can pass those if you want. My guess is you might. Okay. Here's one we might start with. How reliable and extensive is official economic data from China? How does it compare, for example, with data from the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation in developed countries, of the world by and large? Is Chinese data reliability a serious problem?
Yes, I take the data with a grain of salt because I think that their ability to collect them is still not perfect in a lot of ways. For instance, I think that their consumption numbers are underreported. A lot of people think that their consumption is very low, but I think it's much higher because it is a cash economy. And so a lot of that is not recorded. Very few people in China use credit cards. Most of the debt is just in their mortgage. So they may be spending a lot that that's not captured. And in fact, also many Chinese, when they go overseas, as tourists, they tend to spend a lot on high luxury goods because the culture there is that they need to bring back gifts for their colleagues, their bosses, their professors. And all this spending doesn't get captured in the official government statistics. And so yes, I think that the numbers are not always accurate. And also the people who report the numbers tend to not smooth them out the way that economists here in the United States do. They tend to report just raw numbers, and therefore you can see a lot of differences in different areas, which seem very inconsistent, and therefore it's sometimes difficult to gauge what's really going on.
Thank you. I know from your book you're very critical about American foreign aid and Western foreign aid in general, and you have quite a bit of attention to what China is doing in Africa and other countries. And this question relates directly to that subject and to your coverage. What do you see from China's incursion into Africa and other regions globally? What are China's strengths and weaknesses as it expands seeking natural resources and lucrative big projects?
Yeah, so I'm glad that question was asked because that's actually one of the chapters in my book called Soft Power. Joseph Nye originally defined soft power as the ability to influence other cultures through things like the media, food, and other sort of soft ways of selling the American culture. China goes about this in a different way. In China, they believe that actions always speak louder than words. And so for them, they treat soft power as a way to win over friends through their charm offensive, if I can put it that way. So in regards to natural resources and in Africa, unlike the historical empires that have gone into Africa and enslaved the local populations and then took natural resources by force, the Chinese have basically gone to court the leaders there, basically introduce a win-win deal where they say, in return for the natural resources, we will go and build schools for you. We'll build a football stadium for you. We'll build hospitals for you. So that the money that goes into these nations don't go into some dictator's bank account. It actually goes into the public space that benefit the local people. And they follow this method of development for other developing nations that they've used in their own country. And I think that this is a very effective way of doing diplomacy because you are actually serving what the other people want. And I suggest in my book that this is a much less expensive way than spending the trillions we do in our military. And better yet, we don't create enemies this way. We create friends. And we've done that before with the Marshall Plan. We need to do that with developing countries.
Professor Lee, this question refers to one of your colleagues at NYU. I'm not sure I can read the writing. It looks like Professor Rubens or Rulins feels that China is headed for a huge overcapacity, overbuilding, and that it will result in a downturn that could be cataclysmic because of the loose, unregulated banking system. Please comment.
Yes, I get this question a lot. I have a different view on this. I think a lot of people confuse short-term valuations of real estate with the longer development trend because, if I can make an analogy, your Apple stock can fluctuate, say, between 200 and 400. That doesn't necessarily mean that that company has fundamentally changed that much within the company. They probably still have the same employees. They're probably still working on the same projects. So what happens from an outside perspective on the valuation is really not core to what's going on. And what I'm saying with China is that, yes, they may have a short-term correction on their real estate prices because the leadership wanted to put a lid on real estate prices so that they don't go to the stratosphere and keep too many people from being able to buy and purchase these homes. But that doesn't mean that they've overbuilt. Many of these mortgages are secured with 60% down payments, which is unlike our subprime. So even if the prices come down a little bit, there's such a giant equity cushion that the banks won't lose money there. As far as developers developing too much, and you hear about the ghost cities, if they leave and default, basically the Chinese banks, which are largely owned by the country, will just collect that as the collateral. They take over it and they can turn it into low-income housing, which they need to build anyway, because they are forecasting at least 100 million people to migrate from the rural areas to the urban areas in the next 10 years. So 10 million units a year they need to provide adequate housing for all these people. Therefore, a lot of these things I think are overstated, because people can go over there and see that it's empty. Even when I was teaching at Peking University, yes, there were some empty buildings initially when I first arrived, but by the time I left, they were all filled. And so often Western observers don't stay the duration and see that these places do get filled very quickly. So I hope that answers that question.
Here's a related question, actually two questions on planning. Since I'm an urban planner by training, I'm interested in having you address these questions. What effect does China's speedy city building have on the economy? Is it sustainable? And here's another one that's somewhat related. Wouldn't the establishment of a five-year plan by the U.S. government conflict with reliance on the free market system in allocating resources?
No, I'm not necessarily saying that we get rid of free markets. We actually don't really have free markets. Our markets are set up by institutions, and we operate within those rules. What I suggest in my book regarding five-year plans is that we just provide the carrots and sticks, which is no different than what we already have in terms of our tax code, which is very complex. But this would make it more transparent to the American public. Today, we have basically a federal budget that is probably the closest top-down directive that's like a five-year plan. The president would have the OMB put together a budget that would lay out his priorities, and taxpayer money is allocated to different agencies. However, these agencies are not required to deliver anything specific. There are no performance targets next to these things. So it's like a CEO that has a strategic plan, basically giving money to a department and then not asking them to produce a product or to do anything in relation to the money they're receiving. So our taxpayer money today, in some ways, is like going into some black hole, and there's no accountability. And so what I'm saying is that if we put five-year plans in place, or an idea similar where we attach performance targets, that could help solve this inability for us to pump so much money into the economy and still not create jobs.
All right. Professor Lee, what do you think the actual impact of the global financial crisis is on China? Relatedly, what do you think are the long-term consequences of the Chinese being the largest debt holder for the United States?
Well, I believe that this the financial crisis was a big wake-up call to China, because they thought that the U.S. could do no wrong. And after they saw what happened, they started to rethink the financial system that the U.S. had constructed. And so they decided, they realized they need to rely less on the outside nations for direction, and started to rely more on themselves. And of course, this got redirected into their own internal investments, whether it's in infrastructure, but they also invested heavily in innovative areas. So for instance, they know that they need to come up with more inventions to have a sustainable economy, more clean tech, for instance, and have established technology incubators all over their country that simulate a Silicon Valley. And they provide the space for these entrepreneurs to just focus on their research and try to come up with the next disruptive innovation. And this is the result of the fact that the 2008 crisis was a gigantic wake-up call to them. What was the second part of the question?
Well, they're wondering, how do you feel about the fact that China is the largest holder of American debt, U.S. government debt?
Right. Well, it makes China very nervous to be holding debt that potentially could be worthless, right? Because it was in exchange for a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that they had already provided in terms of goods and services to the U.S., in exchange for green pieces of paper. And if they proved to be worthless, then they were working for free. It was basically slave labor then, right? They have no way to enforce anything with us. The best they can do is just sell the debt. They could never say to the U.S., you know, we need something in exchange for it. They don't have that power. The U.S. is very fortunate to be the only sovereign nation with a reserve currency. The seigniorage basically allows us to have access to all the resources in the world just by printing pieces of paper saying this is an IOU. No other nation can do that right now. And this is a privilege that is very similar to past empires. And this is something that we've probably taken for granted. And if we don't recognize that resting on our laurels of this fortunate right that we have, then we could be in trouble down the road. And so what I'm saying is that we need to have a big wake-up call, figure out how to get ourselves competitive so that we can retain a lot of the privileges that we still do have.
All right. Professor Lee, how can we learn from a society that, quote, does not protect intellectual property, disregards the safety of its workers, and has an opaque financial system where fraudulent companies are rampant? How's that for a question? It's got end of quote.
Like I said, there are, we've heard of all the worst things about China. I don't need to repeat them. You've heard them all, and they come up in these questions all the time. But my book is not about advocating these things. I don't advocate any of the things that I don't approve of that go on in China. And I even say in my book that I hope that China continues to reform as well in the areas of human rights, in trying to reduce the corruption at the local level where these people actually don't have to take competency tests and don't have to rotate around. And that's where a lot of heavy corruption goes on, is at the local government officials at these small towns. So that is problematic. But however, I am basically saying that, you know, we have some of these same things too. We have our Madoffs of the world. We have plenty of other corruption as well. If all we do is just look at those things, we're not going to move society forward. And so my message of the book is, let's figure out a more productive conversation to have. And this is why I focus on their best practices.
We are here in the land of Google. And Google indicates that when computer hackers shut down the email accounts of Chinese dissidents, they were treating the dissidents as no different from terrorists trying to cause social unrest. And you indicate in your book that China is justified in protecting its national security by blocking people who have views that are potentially subversive to the national stability of China. So what would you say to the Google people, or what would you say to the American people about hackers and whether or not they dissidents should be have their email monitored or suppressed?
Well, I think that we do that to some extent as well. If someone said that they were part of Al-Qaeda here, I think that would get shut down as well. I think that every nation will view what they think is their national security interests, and it's hard for us to make judgmental calls about what is right or wrong because we're not living there and not understanding the dynamics that go on. Of course, it would be nice to have a much freer, open media in China, and they have been moving that way. 30 years ago, everything was state-owned, and it was very closed, and they controlled all the propaganda. And today, they invite a lot of foreign books into the country. I have all the statistics in my book about the thousands of magazines that get imported there and the thousands of newspapers from around the world. And so they are very much opening their media up. Of course, it's not completely open, but ours is not completely open either. Our Al Jazeera networks are not carried on network TV. We have other issues that every country is going to figure out what their national security interests are. And so I think it's important to realize that there are always multiple sides to the story, and unless we hear all the sides, we should try not to jump to conclusions until we understand what's really going on.
Professor Lee, we have a couple of education-related questions here. Could you comment on the Chinese K-12 education system and how it plays into current cultural, ethical, economic, political successes or failures of China? And they would ask, this one asks for your personal impression of their higher education system based upon your experience in Beijing at the university and your experience at NYU. So your personal views about this, how they compare, what's the quality relationship between the universities in China versus the U.S.?
Yeah, so the first one about K-12, right?
Right.
I would say that the K-12 system is very rigorous. These kids spend a lot of time in school, spend a lot of time doing their homework. In fact, I had heard, speaking to one of the students, that in high school, even during the summer break, they're actually getting up at 7 in the morning to go to school, and then it doesn't end till 11 at night. They work very hard, and they really understand math and science very well. Something that I don't think we take seriously enough. All their teachers there have to have math and science degrees to teach these kids. And the teachers have full reign over the classrooms. They basically don't take any complaints from parents. Parents can't tell them or complain about their teaching methods. It is completely about the teacher having respect and control over the classroom. Very different than what we have here. In regards to the higher levels, I would say that a lot of them are very prepared for higher education. Just to contrast, I had a friend, she teaches freshman English at the New School in New York. And when she heard that I was having a teaching assignment at Peking University, she said, "Oh, Anne, can you please help me get a position there? I really desperately need to leave here." And I asked her why, and she said, "I'm sick of babysitting my students. These people can't write a sentence, and these are freshman college students." And so I think that our K-12 is not adequately preparing a lot of these college students to get in. And so it is a continuous thing between primary to secondary to, you know, higher ed. And even though we do have some of the best universities in this country, that's just a small number. The vast majority of colleges and universities in the U.S. really don't make the cut. And this is a much more serious problem that another friend of mine had published results detailing what's wrong with higher ed that I'm not going to go into right now. But
one of the charges that you frequently hear about Chinese K-12 education is that it does not foster creativity and initiative in their students. Do you have any feelings about that?
Yes, I think that
not your field necessarily, but
I agree. I think they recognize that as a weakness, and I think they're trying to introduce more essay writing and trying to incorporate more field trips. But yes, I would say that that is a weakness of the Chinese system. They need to continue to learn from the U.S. system and incorporate more of that free thinking, more of that creativity early on for their kids. Because I say in the last chapter of my book, you know, what can the Chinese continue to learn from the U.S.? And I say that they need to foster more individuality. Because if you have a society of just bricks and not enough multicolored stones in different sizes, it's not an interesting society. And so I believe that is a weakness that they need to address. The U.S., on the other hand, should try to embrace more of what China's doing so that there's a happy medium that both nations can get to.
Professor Lee, do you have a suggestion for a system to ensure that U.S. politicians are qualified for holding public office similar to Chinese officials? I hesitate to ask that, but it came to me in those words, so go ahead.
Read my book. No.
I know you do. You have very specific about this. Can you summarize?
Like I said earlier in my speech, there's various elements that I think can be adopted in our system to try to attract the kind of people that we want in our government. Today, I think the people that end up in power tend to be the people who are very good in front of the media, tend to be people who can have access to a lot of capital. And these don't necessarily translate into skills that are good qualities to be a leader of a major country. And so I suggest that if we can make these tweaks to our system, that maybe we would attract the people that are turned off by politics today. And that in itself would increase the talent pool for our leadership.
All right, here's a question that begins with a conclusion. Our long-term planning in the U.S. on a national level is subordinate to corporate short-term profits under the laissez-faire capitalism. Can you see a pathway to alter this given the corporate country's corporate orientation for short-term results?
Well, Schumacher wrote a book called Small is Beautiful, and he had a very interesting solution in which instead of companies just traded on the stock market the way they are now, that you have half of the equity belonging to the public, half of it for the people that are running the company, so that you align the interests of the people in the company with the public interest. And in some ways, that's what the Chinese have done with their state-owned enterprises. And I think that this is perhaps a model that we can test out. I'm not sure if we have the right perfect model yet, but one of the chapters I talk about in my book is the idea of systematic experimentation in order to find out what really works. Because so often in economics today, people have theories about what goes on and will have a very complex mathematical model. But these models often are missing very key variables that the people who design these models have no insight into what's going on and therefore miss them. And a better way would be what the Chinese have learned to do is to have pilot projects everywhere and test those theories, very similar to what scientists do to test out a hypothesis, because it can have a completely different result than what you anticipated. And that would be the way to find out the answers to a lot of our big questions.
Professor Lee, I was part of a exchange with the National People's Congress that we began a few years ago, which is ongoing today between the U.S. Congress and the People's National Congress. And of course, we noticed that almost all votes are unanimous there. But one of the areas which you begin to see some differences of opinions that are expressed in votes there is in the environmental area. And this question asks, what do you think the current evolution of thinking is about the Three Gorges Dam in China? This is the Chinese impressions of themselves.
I can't actually have an informed question there because I never asked the Chinese and did any serious polling about what they thought of it.
All right, fair enough. This is a foreign policy type question. It's really the first one we've had. With the overwhelming growth that China is experiencing, do you think that the U.S. feels any pressure to constrain the growth to better please some neighboring nations? Such as, I imagine, China, such as Korea, Japan, India.
So the question is whether the U.S. needs to constrain China's growth.
No, do you think the U.S. is feeling pressure to constrain the growth? The Chinese are concerned always about encirclement. This is something
yes.
they keep mentioning to us, although the U.S. denies that. What do you think about that subject?
I think there's some truth to both sides. I think that there are folks in U.S. Policy circles who are nervous, and that could possibly come from their lack of knowledge about what's going on in China. It could be that there are various interests, whether it's the military or otherwise, who feel that they need more of a reason to exist. And given that we have no serious enemies today, we don't have a Cold War with the Soviet Union. We have gotten rid of so many of our enemies, whether it's Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein or now Kim Jong-il. I mean, we have a situation where the world can be relatively safe and peaceful. And so that could also be a threat to the military, who actually would then face budget cuts if there was really no need to pour more investment there. And therefore, they might create reason to fear of China's growth by using this as an excuse, perhaps.
We're nearly out of time. I'll just ask one final general question. Your opinion about how Sino-American relationships will evolve in the next 5 years?
Well, it's a good question. It's concerning to me because the tone and the rhetoric coming out of politicians here is quite hostile to China, and it didn't used to be that way. We actually were quite friendly with them back in the Nixon days, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan. Our presidents were very close to China back then. And in more recent years, the tone has changed dramatically. And I think this is worrisome because they are our biggest trading partner. And often many Americans will go there and be surprised that, wow, the Chinese really love us. And the Chinese do. They admire us immensely. And so the relationship is really in our hands, whether we decide to treat them as a threat or a competitor or as a friend and a partner is within our power to decide. And I'd like to mention that a friend of mine named Charles Kupchan wrote a book called How Enemies Become Friends. And he basically does the research showing that whether nations get along or go to war depends on what the top leaders decide to do, whether they make a strategic decision to become friendly and broadcast that to the public, or they choose to use very harsh rhetoric and try to create division and nationalistic tendencies in the country. And so it's not clear to me what Obama's intentions are. Or his administration. I have to say that Secretary Clinton's comments about China were not helpful, and his recent decision to announce to the world that the U.S. is moving their military over to the Asia-Pacific region away from the Middle East sent a very hostile message to China that was not helpful in the negotiations subsequently by Tim Geithner to ask for China's cooperation on Iran. If they wanted to do it, they should have reversed that.
Well, this concludes our program for this evening. I want to thank the audience for their terrific variety of excellent questions. I'd like to remind you that Ann Lee's book is available for sale courtesy of Books, Inc., and she'll be available to sign copies here on this stage. But now, I'd like the audience to join me in thanking Professor Ann Lee for her excellent talk and discussion this evening.